Hello and welcome to Leaning Into Light's featured interview for April 2018. I am Jessica Rios, the founder of Leaning Into Light, and I engage in these monthly interviews, conversations, and offer them to listeners, to visitors at Leaning Into Light's website to support you to lean into light. Now, what does that mean? It's kind of poetic. And what does it mean? Leaning into light means to us to recover from pain, from fear, from suffering in life, the not pleasant things, to choose love, to choose joy, to choose to feel good over and over and over again. Because as most of you know, that's a big part of what it takes to live a good life, is to constantly recover to the good feelings. So this is one of our offerings. This is one of the gifts that we give to support humanity every month. You'll find our workshops, interviews, conversations on our website at leaningintolight.com on our workshops page. And they're a gift to humanity to illuminate the beauty of the human spirit, as it is remarkably beautiful in all of us. And sometimes I come across somebody who I just feel like highlighting and sharing more with the world. So that's what today's about. Grab a pen and push pause if needed, so you can grab some paper to take notes. You might find a few things on the call today, on the conversation, that you want to write down. Welcome and thank you for being here. So today we have a special guest named Pete Kirchmer. And Pete, you're here. Hello and welcome.
Hello and thank you.
So I want to give a little bit of, first, I guess I want to tell how we met, because that helps my heart to light up and get even more excited than it is already. So let's see. I remember living in San Diego, and I was at this really quaint coffee shop near the old railroad tracks by the coast, and some friends that were mutual friends of ours introduced me to you, Pete. And you and I had gone through the same coaching program, and I noticed a certain level of, first of all, just immediate, wow, we've done some similar stuff. How cool of, you know, an ally, of somebody who kind of gets my language. I was really excited about that. And in a nutshell, you know, since then, and we've been friends now for 8 years, and I so deeply admire overall your presence, the way that you are with me, with other people who you're with, as I've observed. And it takes a lot of personal work, a lot of self-discovery, a lot of dedication to have the kind of presence you have. So I have utmost respect for how you are in this world. And it's a real honor to know you and have you here today.
Thank you. And I remember that day, and remember feeling your depth of presence as well, and your big heart. I remember 8 years ago. So yeah, thank you for reminding me of that.
Oh, you're so welcome. So a little bit of background about you, Pete, for people who want more of a picture than the coffee shop day that we described. Pete, you are the founder of mindfulness-based health coaching. You are the program director for the UCSD, and that's University of California, San Diego, Center for Mindfulness, MPEAK program. And you also are the developer and lead trainer for the Chopra Center Life Coaching Program. And you're certified by 3 coaching programs, and also a certified Pilates instructor and sports medicine master trainer. So lots of really potent experience you bring to the table, and clearly you're being appreciated by the people who you work with and for. So that is a little bit about Pete, and let's see. So let me just give a little taste for listeners of why this call seemed appropriate for giving to Leaning Into Light listeners today. I notice, I'll start with observation. So I'm in a female body in this life. So I do have a lens that looks through those eyes. We all have masculine, feminine, and I am a woman. I notice among women, I notice among men, they're humans. We struggle with our relationship with our bodies. And this conversation is on mindfulness and a healthy lifestyle, a lot having to do with our relationship with our bodies. And I just know that so many people struggle with this. We might make commitments, we might be committed, and then we slip. And it's constant recovery, and we often need and benefit from having really good support. And I know, Pete, that you provide that to, and have provided that to a lot of people, to have a more healthy lifestyle. Something that sounds kind of basic, but wow, it's a, you know, it's a powerful thing to have. So I would love to start, Pete, because so much of your work is about mindfulness. And frankly, I hear that word so much these days that I kind of lost a grip on exactly what it means. And I'd just love to hear from you. You know, what's mindfulness?
Yeah. And I often give a preface before kind of giving my first explanation or definition of mindfulness. Then the preface is a quote by a teacher, Joseph Goldstein. He says, asking what is mindfulness is like asking what is art. Mm-hmm. And I think what he means by that is that it's subjective, it's context dependent, and also preconceptual. So it is an experience that goes beyond language. An experience through our senses. That being said, the definition in language can be helpful. So I do still offer that. I default to Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition. He's known as the father of modern mindfulness. And he's also known for run-on sentences. So I'll kind of just quote him and then I'll unpack it. He says, it's the awareness that emerges through paying attention on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally to the unfolding of experience moment to moment. So, very, very rich in words there. So the awareness that emerges is like this certain perceptual experience that one can have that I liken to going from like regular audio or video to high definition. Mm-hmm. Or from listening to music through regular headphones to noise-canceling headphones. Same music, same program, different clarity. And so there's a sharpness, a brightness of perception that's available when we pay attention on purpose. And the on purpose part means that there is some gentle effort or intentionality to how we use our attention. There are certain conditions in life that are keeping us at our edge. So, for instance, a rock climber probably doesn't need to intentionally be present. The circumstances and conditions pull the rock climber into presence. And so, at a high level of engagement, we're naturally called into the moment. But for most average regular moments, we need to actually gather our attention and call it into the present moment. So there's this on-purpose quality. And then the present moment itself just means that we're experiencing what's happening through the lens of the senses. We're awake, we're aware, rather than mind wandering into future planning or past memories. But we also come into the present moment with a certain attitude or a quality of attention. We can call that non-judgmental. We can also call it compassionate, kind, allowing, accepting, patient. Right? So a lot of different adjectives could explain this quality of awareness so that we're meeting, excuse me, whatever arises, whether it be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, with this, like, this fundamental okayness, the saying, yeah, this is what's happening, rather than fighting against it. And that this moment continues to unfold. Like, we're in one now and now, right? So it's always the present moment. So that's the definition that I offer to new students.
Yeah. You really painted a flavor. Like, it's not just a picture. I get a feeling of what you're teaching. I can tell you are a teacher of this.
And that feeling that you get is that preconceptual, right? It's the, even beyond the definition, there is a felt sense of what mindfulness is. I'm glad you got that too.
Yeah, it's like a quality of attention. It's like you say, it's high definition. It's like, it's so much more delicious than the average state of awareness we tend to be in, which kind of makes me wonder why is it so hard? Mindfulness, a high level of mindfulness isn't the norm. I'm sure of that, right? I mean, you would probably know better through your observations and your study of it, but right, it doesn't appear to be the norm. But it's so good. So why is it hard?
So actually there is some research that says that the mind is wandering 47% of the time. And so we're not conditioned for mindfulness. We're conditioned to survive and to be efficient creatures. So we go on autopilot. And so mindfulness can be a challenge just because we are reconditioning new brain structures that again have been evolutionarily programmed not to be present to the richness, but to just get away from difficult and to seek out what's pleasant. And we do this unconsciously. And so we're actually waking up. And I would say that it can be difficult because we are going against, you know, our conditioning, but it doesn't have to be stressful. So I do have students that'll say, you know, it's so hard. And often what makes it hard is the expectation that one should be better at it than they are, or that when they are mindful, it should be amazing. And remember, we can be mindful to, relaxed, pleasant state. We can be mindful to a good meal, but we can also be mindful to our own difficulty, our own suffering. Yeah. And so that in itself can be hard. Often we go unconscious or we've learned to repress things that are difficult, and we have all kinds of coping strategies to not be present to our life. And so waking up to, you know, our life as it is sometimes means waking up to things that we haven't wanted it to deal with or to look at, which, you know, it can be challenging.
Absolutely.
And that's why that non-judgmental, compassionate awareness is so important.
It makes me want to shift the question that I asked. So the question is not really what makes it hard, although we do as humans kind of like to say, oh, it's so hard. It's more what makes it so uncommon, or what makes it less common than it might be. And as you say, we're afraid, it's uncomfortable to face things that aren't pleasant or to face things that are extremely unpleasant. And my recent example, and I love to share my personal stories as a testament of living life by the heart, to living life for the sake of love. And here's my little recent story. I'm living in Sweden for a year. I'm in the immigration offices to extend my stay legally. I'm not running from war. I come from Northern California. I'm living in Sweden, both very comfortable places where I live. I feel safe. I look around, and in the lobby of the immigration offices, which are very comfortable and very clean and beautiful and well lit, I see about 150 people, most of whom have come from places where they don't feel safe. Most of whom have come from places that are experiencing war. Some of which has been caused by my own country's decisions. Some of which has been paid for by my taxes. I have a really big heart. I feel this, and it's so sad. And I want to walk around and hug everyone, or really better yet, just hold their hands and look into their eyes and apologize. And I know that's probably not what I'm going to do, and it's not what I choose to do, but the grief is so big. And like you said, you know, Pete, you've found research where the mind wanders 47% of the time, you know, I probably felt that grief and then I left it and I went and ate lunch and I focused on some bok choy, you know, stir fry for a little while. And then I went back into it with somebody who was willing to listen to my story and not tell me it's okay, you know, and try to get me out of the grief. But I hear you. It's, being mindful all the time is a high bar.
Thank you for sharing that story.
Yeah. So mindfulness. So moving along, I want to weave through our conversation here today elements of just a feeling of self-care, you know, as listeners, as you're present to this conversation and to the kind of work that Pete does, you know, what are the notes you can take on taking care of yourself? You know, what if you were the awesomest thing in the world? And you are. So sit with that and take out your pen. And whenever something comes out that you think, I'm going to do that for myself, write it down. And if you only do 1 out of 10 things, that's cool because that's one more than you did yesterday. So just a reminder to take out your pen. And if, by the way, you're somebody who could just listen to a really short part of our conversation today, I just want to tell you, if you wanted to get in touch with Pete for one reason or another to learn more about his work, his website, correct me, Pete, if I'm wrong, is mindfulnessbasedhealth.com.
Yep.
Okay. So moving along, relationship, I want to explore a little bit about our relationship with food. And again, I'm a woman. I've got my own experiences. A short snippet I want to share to frame this a little bit to get insight for listeners, many of whom will share challenges with me around this. I'm going to throw out the word sugar. And, listeners have their own responses that come up when I say that. There's a lot of emotional dependency on sugar. And I will share that I personally, since childhood, have turned to sugar for emotional consolation. It's still something in my early 40s now that I struggle with. And as I walk down the street here in Sweden and look at some of the bakeries in the windows and I see this beautiful pastry that's just like, oh, so divinely done. I go, oh, that looks so good. And it looks like it would feel so good to eat. And it looks like it would taste so good. And I know that there are so many other women, and probably men too. I definitely know the women. And women are the ones who fill these pastry shops often. You know, we're drawn to it for emotional reasons. And, you know, that's not necessarily very helpful. So I would love to hear from you, Pete. You know, if you've ever worked with somebody who, have you ever worked with somebody who struggled with sugar in their?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. How do you support people who are emotionally, who are in that place?
Well, you've kind of already nailed the first step, which is identifying that it's emotional in the first place. So a lot of people haven't deeply inquired into their relationship with food. And when they do, we find that, we eat for comfort, we eat for distraction, we eat for fuel. We often go unconscious when we're eating for distraction or for comfort. It's common for people to have the experience where they literally will tell me, like, they woke up in the bottom of a bag of chips. I mean, by woke up is like they don't really remember eating food. So waking up to the choice to eat is like a step one. Asking yourself, am I really hungry or what am I really hungry for, is a practice that I often will give a client so that when they walk by that pastry window, they can feel that impulse and that craving. And then they can get curious. What is it that I'm really hungry for? What is it that I really want? Sometimes it's just truly a sense pleasure. Sometimes it's a reward. Sometimes it's, I don't want to feel what just happened earlier today. Sometimes it's just seeking a different state. Or when they can pause and look at what is it they're really wanting, well, that kind of breaks the trance. And then that also gives them the power to choose. Now, they might still choose to eat it, but at least there is that pause and the choice rather than the knee-jerk reaction and then the, oh, whoa, where did the pastry go? And if they do choose to eat it, then we practice savoring it, feeling the body and the impact of that food, tasting it fully, smelling it, and like really like showing up and enjoying it if you're going to do it. Mm-hmm. And so really that's the practice of mindfulness around eating is to wake up to the choice and to the motivation or intention behind why you're doing what you're doing.
And have you seen mindfulness help people heal their relationships with sugar, with food?
Yes. And now often the question, so I love that you ask that versus the most popular question is, does mindfulness or does mindful eating help people lose weight? And so the answer to that question is, I don't know. You know, sometimes the research is a little varied when it comes to that. But when it comes to healing relationship with food, either people can begin making new choices and they can see the food or any addictive device for that matter, alcohol, in a new way. They see it more fully. Meaning we often project a lot onto food, a lot of nostalgia, mm-hmm. or onto, you know, again, we can use caffeine, alcohol, any addictive device. And we can start to tease apart the actual sugar, the actual substance, and all of the meaning that we're placing upon it, all of the expectations, the hopes, and then we can just see the food as food. And in this way, it can downgrade itself in importance. It loses some of its craving. So that's one experience. The other experience, though, is that people perhaps can continue to eat what they want to eat, but without beating themselves up. And this is why I would say, like, I don't know if it helps people lose weight or not, because I've had clients that sometimes come to me and they want to lose weight, and they do, and they change their relationship with food and they make new choices and they end up, reaching their external goals. But I've had other clients who still consider themselves successful, within our coaching and within their mindfulness practice, who just learn to love themselves even with, an impulse to eat sugar. And they just decide that that's okay. And then without beating themselves up, paradoxically, they often don't go as unconscious because it's a downward spiral. We eat a little sugar. We realize we've eaten the sugar. We start to feel bad about ourselves and feel shame and guilt. And what do we do when we feel shame and guilt? Eat more sugar.
Yeah.
And so what they can do is just eat the initial sugar without the guilt and shame, and then don't have to go round two. And so it doesn't spiral so deeply out of control. And they just get to enjoy, the initial treat that they'd wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love that you're presenting, clearly a finding, a belief that you have, which is that there is no one right way. It's really up to each person to explore what is my relationship with food, to get curious about it, and to find a way to feel balanced, feel honest, and feel good about it. And for one person, that may be continuing their love affair with ice cream, and for another person, it may be letting the ice cream go, except for once a month or forever.
Yes.
But Yeah, that's why I, and you are a masterful coach, and I have a not so secret dream that each person on the planet would have the kind of love that you give your clients.
Mm-hmm.
Because so often in conversations with friends, it's like, here's my story, and oh, blah, 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 and then let me hear your story, and you end up, you hang up the phone, it's like, I'm still not like, why wasn't that so good, and sometimes with friends it's not like that, it does feel great, but with a masterful coach it always is like, oh my god, that was so good, so much better than I really could have even imagined. And I know that you bring that. I know you bring it because you're a friend and peer of mine, and I know that you bring it to your clients. So may there be more of that in the world.
And it's true. We all just have this deep yearning to be seen and to be heard.
Yeah. We're really good at it with kids. Well, okay. We won't go down that tangent for now. So far we have explored what mindfulness is, what a fun dive that was into the feeling of it. And you've shared some tools on our relationship with food and having a healthy relationship when it comes to food and mindfulness on that. I'm curious now, so again, bringing in some of my life stuff. I have a rich life, not financially, but I have a rich life in substance. And I love to share what I've experienced and how I've explored it and the beauty that I've found in it and the silver linings, even with the pain. I love to share it with people. So I'm going to bring in here the topic of pain and the body's communication, the way the body communicates. And personally speaking, I've had for 2 years now, almost every month, acutely painful migraine headaches that last anywhere from 6 days to sometimes, the longest one was about 15 days. So really, really painful, really strong messaging from the body. Migraines are complex. It's not like a knee injury where it's a little more straightforward or a lot more straightforward. So I've done a lot of thinking about, you know, the way the body communicates and how to respond to it with love and take care of it. And pain is not something that humans always like to look at, right? We want to automatically stick drugs on it, cover the pain, get away from it as quick as possible. So I guess first I'm just curious, have you, you know, let's say, Pete, 1 out of 10 coaching clients you work with, how many people end up, out of 10, how many people end up bringing up pain? Is it a, across the board, humans experience pain and bring it up as a learning tool and as a life discovery?
You know, I it's hard to say what, you know, how much it comes up in, with coaching clients. Some it's a primary goal for coaching, and, you know, in others it might just come up, through, you know, it's a random occurrence and sometimes never. So, but what I do know is that, no one avoids pain throughout a lifetime. And so it's an experience that everyone has had, including myself, and it was definitely, the motivator for me to start this path. It was a second spine surgery that left me with partial paralysis of the left leg and this realization that things were going to need to be different. And I would say that, you know, pain has been one of my primary teachers. So it can be, you know, quite rich when we interpret pain in that way as a teacher, versus the alternative, which is to be a victim of pain. And I would say that this observation was something that I made early in my career, actually right out of college. I got my degree in physiology with the intention to be a physical therapist. And so working in physical therapy through college, I became very interested in the patient's relationship to pain and could see that those who felt victimized, who felt like they were angry at their employer, angry at their, you know, the person that hit them in the other car, they had a very different experience than someone who took it as an opportunity to pause and reflect on their life, to make changes, who saw it as, you know, in a bigger picture way of like, oh, maybe this is my body or this is life trying to communicate something with me. Those people seemed to suffer less, and also it seemed like they healed faster. So pain is fascinating, and mindfulness can help us in multiple ways in the way we work with pain. And I would say that when I'm teaching people or courses around mindfulness and pain, the first thing we talk about is the distinction between pain and suffering. And pain is a physical sensation. It's an experience. If we're talking about a migraine, it might be throbbing, pulsing, heavy, pins and needles, sharp, stabbing, burning, right? So there's all of these different adjectives we'd use to explain the direct experience of the sensations of pain. But then there's also the emotional and then there's the mental components to it as well, right? So there's some story in the mind. For me, and my back pain, it was, oh no, I'm not going to be able to play sports. And if I can't play sports, I'm going to lose my friends. And right, there's this whole a feeling of loss of identity. There was the emotion of feeling, emasculated in some way because I had my identity tied up in my physical strength. And so feeling like less of a man, feeling a little bit helpless. And all of these emotions and kind of storylines in the mind make the experience, the overall gestalt of pain, so much worse than the actual, physical stabbing pain, which is bad enough as it is. And so we learn to tease these components apart with mindfulness. We start to say, okay, that's the story, that's the emotion, and this is the actual physical pain. So that's one way. And then there's also our conditioned reaction to pain, whether it be to fight against it, to get mad at the pain, or to try to fix it, right? How many people have found, I call it the Dr. House syndrome. You know, you get some indigestion and then you find yourself up at 2 a.m. on WebMD and you've diagnosed yourself with, four different, I have leaky gut. No, maybe it's a parasite. No, maybe it's, whatever diagnoses you give yourself. And then we're in a panic. And so we're trying to fix it. Or we're trying to flee it with either medication or distraction or food or so different avoidance techniques. And so we can start to also see the way that we react to pain, and then pause and be more mindful in choosing a response of how we want to care for ourselves when we are experiencing pain versus the unconscious, this unconscious impulse that can often make the experience so much worse.
There's an echo here around, you say pause, we can pause, we can choose. There's a slowing down that you're presenting, and it's echoing when you talked about food and how it's okay, for some people they choose to just have that pastry and enjoy it and savor it. Savoring is a slow thing. You can't rush through savoring. So I'm gathering the feeling, here around mindfulness really being a lot about a choice to pause, to savor, so that we can be aware and choose more consciously, more based on. Yeah. Hey, I'm learning from you. Your stuff is contagious. So, okay, Pete. So, pain, there's one last kind of general field I wanted to play with in conversation with you today. And again, I pulled these things because I know you to a certain degree. I know your work. I respect you and your work so much. And I think, wow, I get so much from what you share. What could I share about my life that I feel like is so rich and other people can, can learn from it, can also enjoy the richness of your wisdom and the work you've done and the experience that you have to share based on it. So the topic that came up, the other thought that I was having is around productivity. So like, how much can I produce? How many things that are super awesome, on any given day can I have written down on my to-do list or not even written down? And I still, I did them, I did all that. And I have these thoughts and then I have migraines and suddenly I cannot do anything. I am flat. There is a black cloth over my eyes. Any light hurts. No screen time. you know, no multitasking. That absolutely hurts my brain, makes it feel more inflamed and stabbing, like you said. I can laugh now. I wasn't laughing a week ago. But, you know, it's this productivity thing. And then I'm going, like, I'm laying there and I'm like, oh man, am I trying to do too much in life? And then suddenly it slams me down and says, sorry, that hurts, but you're not really paying attention to how much it hurts for you to try to be so damn productive. So down, girl. And down I go. And I wonder. So you work with people around, largely around, you know, peak performance and how to use mindfulness to build strength and have a healthy lifestyle and a healthy relationship with your body. You probably work with a lot of people who are highly productive or want to be highly productive. Would you say there's a wide range in people's like healthy productivity level? I mean, for listeners on this call, say, you know, are there some people for whom productivity is a drip of the faucet, one drip here and one a few hours later? And for some, it's like, you know, I can't think of an example of who, but me, when I'm kind of being my normal, like boom, 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 boom. Is there a wide range? Is there variety?
Sure. Yeah. And so I work with people on, you know, for healthy lifestyle change, for stress resilience, and for performance enhancement. And so, you know, in the realm of performance enhancement, productivity is often a, you know, a topic that comes up. And I actually see a wide spectrum of people. And so some are overachieving perfectionists, and then others really are blocked and not, you know, and so, for some of the clients who just are stuck, it's really exploring, you know, what the fears are, what the distractions are, both internally and externally. So that they can free up their energy and their flow and start giving their gifts and doing what they intend on doing. But then, yes, like as you say, there's the other extreme, which are people who have just placed so many demands and expectations on themselves and are constantly in this mode of what we'll call striving. And I define striving as being this jaw-clenching, teeth-grinding, nail-biting, white-knuckled effort to force an outcome. Mm-hmm. It often ends in burnout, injury, or overwhelm. And so it's not sustainable as far as an energy. And yet there are a lot of people that believe that they can sustain this. But you know, our bodies are like vehicles with multiple gears, and we can't redline it, you know, the whole time. Luckily we can for a short period. You know, we were built that if it is time to sprint, we can sprint, but we can't sprint, you know, for weeks and months and years on end. And so for the overstrivers, kind of overproducers, like a radical challenge for them is to learn how to do less, to really slow down and to check in with their body and see what it actually can do effectively. Because at some point, the, you know, we lose efficiency with the illusion of productivity, or just spinning in circles but not really getting anything done. Some of our greatest insights, some of, you know, the world's best inventions and discoveries have come from, you know, sitting under the apple tree, or just a relaxed state where we're able to channel our own creativity, not from, you know, the grind. And so I teach people to shift into this more creative mode versus a productive mode. There's a time to be productive. And when it is, we look at, you know, how do we focus our attention on the task at hand? And if it's checking emails, you notice distraction, you return, you set a timer, you go for it for an hour. You know, any thought that comes up that tries to tell you otherwise, you just let that thought go and you just keep writing that article or whatever you said you were going to do. But then also creating space where we can clear the mind and get into more of a flow where the challenge that we put in front of ourselves is equally proportionate to our skill level, or it's just a little bit higher than our skill level. And in those conditions, when our skill meets our challenge, then we can be in this flow. But when we're always creating a challenge that so much exceeds our skill and our energy reserves, then again, we're in overwhelm and we're not actually being productive. So finding the sweet spot with how much my clients can take on effectively is one strategy. And then learning to shift into this mind state or this space of awareness that feels more spacious, that allows for creative thoughts, is another actual skill set. And it's a capacity that is cultivated through the practice of mindfulness meditation.
Yeah. I'm like, what the world needs now is mindfulness. I'm just like, oh God, this is just, it's just so good. It really is. I will speak for a number of women who really are feeling called to honor the feminine within us, because we, as you know, we have masculine and feminine within all of us, and there's this cultural push. I see it in America. I see it in Sweden, to be really productive. And beneath it, there's this softer, fluid voice that wants us to simmer down a bit. Like you said, stop striving so much. Find that creative space. And I love the image you presented of the apple tree. You know, yeah, it's often the beautiful ideas do come when we're quiet and we're open, and not getting in our own way. So, Pete, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your experience, your love for people. I hear so much in your voice and in the words that you have woven from all the people you've supported, that you really deeply care and really believe in people to find that more still place where peace of mind lives. I really appreciate your work, and I'm so grateful that you took the time to be with us today.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, and for you bringing your own personal examples, your rich questions, and your endless enthusiasm for life. Thank you.
You're welcome. So listeners, if you would like to get in touch with Pete, you can find him on his, well, you can find information about him on his website, and you can pick up the phone and give him a call from there. His website is mindfulnessbasedhealth.com. And Pete's located in San Diego. Ooh, the sun of San Diego is very appealing to a person living in the Swedish winter. and Pete can coach people from all over the world. So giving a real pat on the back to you listeners for being with us today, listening and taking whatever it is for you that makes your life more of a mindful place, more of a high definition, slowed down, creative, sparked up, whatever kind of place really, really makes you feel alive. And if you've found this useful, show love today to somebody, pick a person and share it with them. Send them the link over email, do whatever it takes. They might be sitting at their desk all day or commuting long hours and they could use an uplift. And I would love to know that they're getting something from this as well. So remember that these are monthly interviews. They are all on our website at leaningintolight.com on our workshops page. And we are taking a break from social media, possibly for a whole year. We're on day two, and it's a fun adventure. So if you'd like to get more updates on these and make sure you're reminded when these are available, you can sign up for our newsletter on our website. And I send those once or twice a month. So that's again at leaningintolight.com. We will see you next month.